Thank you, Avi, for inviting me to speak here today. It's a pleasure. I will hopefully be with you in person next week. So let me just jump right in. So I'm a theorist, as Avery mentioned, and I'm interested in experimental tests of gravity with black hole images, like the ones you see on the bottom here. And I will tell you in the first part a little bit about how we measure space-time using such black hole images currently, and what the future prospects look like. So these will be future black hole images as well as movies that will hopefully be taken at higher angular resolution and flux sensibility. So these will be sharper images, and hope and the idea would be to see what we can learn about gravity from those future measurements. So these two black holes that the UHT observes, M87 and Sagittarius A-star, these host hot accretion flows. And so we will also, in the second part of my talk about hot accretion, simulations of hot accretion in non-curved black hole spacetimes. So these are new simulations, and these I will use to first talk about how there are observable differences between the simulated images of curved black holes and non-curved black holes. So this then gives us some, this then puts us on firm footing that you can actually tell the difference between the different kinds of black holes. My focus in this in the second latter half of the talk will actually be on the jets that these black holes produce. So shown here is a HST image of M87, and you can see this. I hope you can see my cursor. So there's this long collimated streak. This is an outflow, relativistic outflow of magnetized plasma, and these are quite powerful outflows. And they're thought to be generated by the black holes at the center of galaxies. So the question we will be asked with these simulations was, what sets the jet power of a black hole? Like, how does it depend on the space-time geometry of the black hole, the specifics, which space-time you're talking about, which space-time you're working with, or are there some general universal physics that we can sort of obtain? So this will be the second part of my talk. So this is all sort of motivated by the recent wonderful observations of black holes. So on the top here, I show the first announcement of a gravitational wave detection. This is from a binary black hole, GW159714. And on the bottom here is the first announcement of a black hole image, M87. And the first thing that both of these papers do is to assure us that all these observations are consistent with general relativity. This is quite important because we use GR to understand various physical and astrophysical phenomena. The next thing that both papers do immediately is very presciently tell us that these observations could help us understand more about strong field gravity. And that's what the focus of my talk will be. The history of experimental gravity is quite rich. So shown here is this nice parameter space. On the x-axis is the gravitational potential at which these tests are performed, the characteristic gravitational potential. This is roughly like the mass divided by the radius. So this would be the mass of a star. This is the characteristic mass of the system and the characteristic separation size of the system. On the y-axis here is the characteristic curvature at which this test is performed. So this is something like the root of the Kretschmann scalar. So you can see here that the solar system tests all lie here. There's a triple pulsar system right here. And the black hole tests, the true strong gravity tests, are up here. So you can see gravitational waves occupying this part of the parameter space, and the Event Horizon Telescope image is occupying this part of the parameter space. So with different experiments that we perform, we fill up this parameter space, and we test the validity of GR all across this region. So okay, I will come to the black hole images momentarily, but let me highlight one important distinction. So the gravitational wave mergers, the gravitational wave events are coming from mergers of stellar mass objects, whereas the images are of supermassive objects. So you can see that in the difference between the y-axis scales here. So these are 8 orders of magnitude in difference in mass. Furthermore, what we're testing with gravitational waves versus images is quite different aspects of the theory. So with gravitational waves, you have a binary black hole merger that is that's occurring in a highly dynamical space-time, and you also have gravitational waves that are being emitted. So what we're testing with gravitational waves is the dynamical aspects of general relativity as well as the radiative aspects of GR. With the black hole images, the space-time is essentially time independent or stationary. So what we're testing there is the space of stationary solutions of general relativity, as well as how plasma moves, because these are accreting black holes, as well as how plasma moves in these stationary black hole spaces. So you can see that we're actually testing different aspects of the theory, not just on this parameter space, but like fundamentally as well. So another way to say that we're testing the space of stationary space-time is to say that we are measuring space-time geometry. And to sort of get into this, let me tell you a little bit about the Kerr metric, and then we can understand what we mean by non-Kerr metrics quite straightforward. So the Kerr metric is the stationary vacuum solution of general relativity, and it's given by this line element. I'm pretty sure everybody in this room is quite familiar with this, but yeah, it looks quite simple once you get to know it, I guess. But it depends only on two parameters, this capital M, which is the ADM mass of the space-time, and this small a, which is the specific angular momentum of the space-time. And I mentioned that this is a vacuum solution of GR. So if you look at the Einstein equations, on the left here is the Einstein tensor, the script G, which is a function purely of the metric. And on the right-hand side is the matter content of the space-time, the stress-energy tensor. So if you take this GAB of the metric of Kerr and put it into the left-hand side, it vanishes, telling us that the right-hand side is also zero, and this is a vacuum space-time. Okay, so you can also see that the Kerr metric describes black holes when this spin parameter is less than or equal to m, and in particular, the zero spin limit is the Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, this is a theoretical picture of a Kerr black hole. On the outermost yellow line here is the ergo surface of the black hole, and on the orange line here is the event horizon of the black hole. And here I've also shown this picture also shows the inner horizon in the dashed yellow line and the inner ergo surface in the dashed orange line. This dotted line here is the ring singularity, is the curvature, strong curvature singularity, which is at present at, in the equatorial plane of the black hole. And finally, this blue shaded region is the ergo region of the black hole. And this is the guy that will be very important for the second part of the talk when I will talk about jet power. Okay, so this is what you can see from these formulae that are shown here is that everything depends purely on M and E. This is a very special metric, and everything is determined by just the mass and the spin of the black hole. And this leads to the statement that, okay, so that Kerr black holes have no other hair. And also to the expectation that all astrophysical black holes also have no other hair. So this is something that we can sort of test. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, by tests of GR in the context of the Event Horizon Telescope, we actually mean tests of the Kerr black hole metric because we're the space-time is fixed, assumed to be fixed. Okay, some reasons to consider alternative space-times. Kerr black holes have problematic interiors. Firstly, like I mentioned, they have a ring singularity right at the center. Furthermore, the region between the ring singularity and the inner horizon, if you're located somewhere there, you can actually receive signals from the ring singularity. So there is a violation of the weak cosmic censorship inside the inner horizon. Furthermore, the inner horizon itself is unstable through mass inflation instability. Therefore, you have all these issues that you may want to sort of fix. And I'd also just mention that the interior, the region between the two horizons is also not stationary, but this is not a problem, a generic feature. So we want to fix these kinds of problems. And one of the ways that we can go about doing this is by looking at phenomenological resolutions to each of these problems. So for example, you can look at black holes that are regular. There are regular black hole models that have been proposed, and they will modify your metric tensor in some way, which means immediately that the Einstein tensor is modified, and generically you would expect that it has some matter content. So the space-time has some matter. Also, you could try to get rid of the inner horizon by arranging your metric in certain ways, and that will also lead to some matter distribution in the space-time. So these are all no, examples of non-pure black holes. These are different ways in which you could change the metric and get and try to inspect different kinds of physics. So ideally, the candidate that we want, the golden target, is the guy that has no singularity as well as no probably inner horizon, so that this is unstable, so that the entire space-time generically in the interior is also stable. Another thing that we can do is to remember that the Einstein tensor itself could be changed. So let me step back a little and say that that singularities, space-time singularities, occur generically in general relativity. There are theorems by Penrose and Hawking and others that show that you must generically be able to form naked, be able to form space-time singularities in general relativity because of focusing of light rays. And so close to the center of these singularities, we might expect that the Einstein equations are modified, and that heuristically will reflect in a modified Einstein tensor, Einstein light tensor, and you could have different theories that sort of try to incorporate these modifications. So there are all these different things that make it interesting to consider alternative space times to the curved black hole space times. Furthermore, what you could also do is to look at parameterized metrics. These are black hole metrics that deviate from the curved metric in some particular fashion. And what you can do by looking at these deviations is to understand by looking at these deviations is to sort of constrain them and therefore perform agnostic tests of the curved metric. So again, as soon as you modify the metric tensor, you would typically get a non-zero stress tensor, and therefore these space times are all non-empty black hole space times. So there are a number of these parameterized metrics that have been used in the literature. For example, this Konopka-Rozsa-Zhidenko or the Johansson-Stahlfest metric, and we'll use both of these to some extent later. Okay, so with that general broad introduction, let me just jump into the first part and tell you about. Oh, that shouldn't have, yeah. So let me just jump into the first part and tell you a little bit about what we mean, what current tests of gravity and future tests of gravity will look like. So I will restrict in this part to spherically symmetric black holes because it makes matters simple, and I'll make some comments on spinning black holes later. Okay, so the general metric for a spherically symmetric black hole, you can write down like this. It has three metric functions, F, G, and R, and you can remove one of them by a quantum transformation always. But we will keep all these three just to be flexible. So in particular, the Schwarzschild metric is given like this. Okay, in these spacetimes, solving for photon orbits is extremely simple because you can find that they have four conserved quantities: the rest mass of the photon, the energy of the photon, the azimuthal angular momentum, and the total angular momentum. So you might immediately think that you have both a conserved azimuthal angular momentum and a total angular momentum, and this is reminding you of the Kepler problem, and this is exactly right. So all you can show quite easily that all particles move on planar orbits in these spacetimes. So this really simplifies the problem, and in particular, the ratio of the total angular momentum and the energy gives you the impact parameter of the photon. So this is the radius on the image plane on the sky that this photon will appear at. Okay. And because of strong gravity close to the black holes or close to the event horizon, you will find that photons can move on circular orbits. So the radial velocity and the radial acceleration will be zero. And such locations just outside the horizon are called photospheres. So you can solve for the radius and the impact parameter of the photon on such an orbit using these two equations. So this is just r dot equal to zero and r double dot equal to zero. And you can see that you solve one differential equation, you get the radius of the photon sphere, and you can put it into the right-hand side, and you can obtain the size, the gravitational lens size of the photon sphere on the sky. This latter guy is what we call the shadow. In the Schwarzschild metric, the photon sphere is at 3m, and the shadow size that this black hole casts on the sky will be 3√3m. So we talked about black holes that the EHT observes having some accretion disks. So let's just understand, heuristically understand what we see and how we relate it to the shadow size. So here on the top left is some analytic model for an accretion disk. It has some emission coming from this, from the equatorial plane, and the observer is sitting somewhere here. So you can see, you can track photons, you can trace photons back from the observer sky, and they follow different orbits in the spacetime. And you can show the image plane intensity profile as a function of the impact parameter of these photons, which is the radius on the image plane, in this way. So what you can see is that this photon here, this A photon, it picks up very little intensity when it arrives on the sky. The C photon, which is going through a larger path length, it intersects the disk here as well as here. It has a larger intensity, and so on. So what you can see is that this sharp peak that you find is exactly the shadow boundary. When you blur this image on the sky, you will generally expect to find that the maximum of the intensity is closely tied to the shadow boundary of the black hole system for this region. And it is exactly this that we use to sort of test GR with the event-horizon telescope images. In the first set of papers with M87 already, it was established that M87 is consistent with being a curved black hole. In a more recent paper in 2020, these authors looked at different deformations, parametric deformations of the curved metric, and tried to constrain some here on the black hole spacetimes. And finally, more recently, we looked also at specific solutions or to alternative black hole space to alternative black hole theories, and we also asked whether you could constrain those spacetimes with these black hole images, and we found that you could also constrain some sort of set some constraints on something. Okay, we can do the same thing with Sagittarius A-star, and you can find that we find qualitatively similar results. And this is published in paper 6 of the Sagittarius A series. Okay, so in the future, I mentioned that we will be able to look at, we will be able to take images at higher angular resolution and flux sensitivity. So this is what we hope to find. Here on the left is a movie of a simulation of accretion onto a curved black hole spacetime. And what you see is this sharp feature here, which is called the photon rent. And you can see on the movie here that you can this ring, you can this is a snapshot at a particular time, but now you're varying the inclination of the observer. And you can see this sharp ring to be persistent throughout all inclinations. The sharp ring is what we call the photon ring, and it's actually a collection of all higher order images of the entire accretion flow. I will come back to this in a second, but roughly you can think of a single snapshot like this. You can split it into different order images, and all the higher order images will appear closer and closer to this ring, and that's what is forming this photon rent. Okay, so let's just talk about higher order images briefly. So let's consider this scenario where you are an observer in a spherically symmetric black hole spacetime for simplicity. Here's the observer. Here's a hot blob of gas that is emitting some photons. And like I said, all the photons in this spacetime move on planar orbits. So the photon orbits will just be in the plane of the screen. So there is one photon that connects this emitter and this observer, and this undergoes a angular deflection of just theta emit because the observer is on the north pole of the coordinate system. So the observer, the final destination, final angular position of the photon is zero, and it just corresponds. The total angular deflection it experiences is just the initial emission angular location. There is yet another photon that goes around the black hole once and reaches the observer. So you can see that this guy undergoes a larger angular deflection, and in particular that, and more specifically that there are an infinite number of these. You can go around the black hole in infinite number of ways. And you can just find that the angular deflection of all these photons is given in this fashion because of this modulo 2 pi. Okay, what you can also find is that the angular deflection of photons is dependent on this plus minus sign as well as this n, and they increase in this fashion. So you can get rid of all this plus, minus, and m, and all this nonsense. And you can index this set by n. And this is what we mean by the order of the image. So n equal to 0 is the zeroth order image, which is formed by the photon that is undergoing the least amount of angular deflection. The first order image is formed by the photon that undergoes the next highest amount of angular deflection, and so on. So this is what we mean by the order of an image of a point source. You can imagine then that the order of the entire accretion flow, the image of the entire accretion flow, is just the sum of the zeroth order or the first order images of the entire accretion flow. So this is what we mean by different order images. So here I show you the higher order images of point emitters located just outside the horizon in a Schwarzschild black hole spacing. So you can see as you move from the North Pole, so I will assume that the observer is on the North Pole at infinity. As you move from the air, when you change the emitter angular location from the North Pole to the South Pole, you can see that these photons are approaching on the image plane close to this line, which is the shadow boundary, which I talked about earlier. Similarly, you can draw the orbits of the n equal to 1 photons. So you can see they are emitted from the same emitter location. They loop around the black hole and appear on the opposite side of the screen. And you can see that they're also getting very close to this red line here, which is the shadow boundary. What this tells us, what you also can see, is that the total size of the image is also shrinking, is becoming thinner and thinner. So indeed, you can do this for all order images. So I show you the first five order images. The even order images on the top all appear on the right side of the screen. The even order images, the odd order images on the bottom all appear on the left side of the screen. So this is roughly what you can expect from higher order images. And also you can see that the demagnification of the entire image is quite drastic. So you can see that here it has some radial extent, it gets smaller, it gets even smaller, and so on. In fact, this is true for emitters located at any radius, not just outside the horizon. Across the rows, I vary the location of the radial location of the emitter. And you can see both this squeezing of the images as well as this clipping between consecutive order images quite clearly. In fact, what you can find is that the radius at which the n plus one order photon appears. Okay, so what this is telling you is, so the eta n plus one is the radius of the n plus one order photon. Eta n is the radius of the nth order photon on the image plane. And eta ps is the shadow size. So this tells you that the n plus one order photon is approaching the shadow exponentially quickly. And this exponent here, I see there's a talk, there's a question.
Oh yeah, thanks. Sorry. So I was just curious if the even order images have opposite parity from the odd order images. Like, do you know or?
Yes. By parity, do you mean?
Oh
What
yeah.
exactly
Like,
do you mean?
so are they flipped relative to the opposite order?
I see. No. This is a bit of a tricky question. So if you take, I will show you an image of a ring later on, and you will see
Okay, great,
that
great.
they don't have they will not have flipped parities.
Okay, great, great, thanks.
Okay. So as I was saying, the radial deviation from the shadow boundary diminishes exponentially rapidly, and this exponent here, this scaling exponent, is called the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent. And this guy is also purely defined by the space-time geometry. So if you measure some of these images and you measure these kinds of properties, maybe you can back out this Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent in this way. Okay. So this scaling relation that I showed actually stems from a much more deeper set of universal relations between the properties of different photons. And we can understand this in this way. Okay, so at the photon sphere itself, photons are going on circular orbits. So the angular deflection that they will experience is infinite. They're just going on loops continuously, and therefore they'll be infinitely they will undergo infinite angular deflection. So if you look at a photon that is just outside the photon sphere, that guy you would expect is also going to loop around the black hole many, many number of times. And the impact parameter of the photon on that photon orbit is also going to be very close to the impact parameter of the photon on the photon shell itself. So what you can write down is this sort of scaling relation between the angular deflection experienced by a photon and the fractional impact parameter. So this eta bar I define as the difference between the impact parameter and the shadow size, the fractional difference between the two. And furthermore, what you can see is that you can link always the angular deflection between consecutive order images for equatorial sources in this simple way. This is deflected by an extra half loop. Therefore, you can use these two relations to work out that their impact parameters differ in this exponential way. Okay. So similarly, what you can find is that the extra time that the n plus one order photon takes before arriving on the screen is also fundamentally determined by the black hole properties, and it's given by pi times the shadow size. So this is because the way that you can imagine this time difference is that you have the nth order photon that's appearing in the sky. The n plus one order photon has an extra half loop very close to your photon sphere. So you can think of the extra time difference between the two orbits as the half orbital time of the photon on the photon sphere itself. And here, omega is the angular velocity of the photon on that circular orbit. So in this way, you can see that the time difference is also fundamentally related to the shadow size. So if you measure the time difference between two different order images, you would probably get an independent estimate of the shadow size. Okay. So let me just introduce all the space-time critical parameters to you now. We had the black hole metric that we talked about in spherically symmetric spacetimes, and we also showed that the photon sphere and the shadow radius are given by these two equations. Notice that this metric function g does not appear in any of these equations. That's quite interesting. And now this Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent you can work out as I showed you in the previous slide as I defined it. It's related to it's given by this combination of metric functions and derivatives. And this kappa hat guy is the phase space Lyapunov exponent. Let me tell you what this means. So consider two orbits. One, you have a photon that's on the photon sphere and showing you the radius on the x-axis and the affine parameter along the photon on the y-axis. So the guy on the photon sphere, this orange guy, will always remain at constant radius. Then you can look at a photon that's just outside the photon sphere with similar angular momentum. What you will find is that it will exponentially deviate away from the photon sphere radius. And this exponential deviation is controlled by this phase space Lyapunov exponent. So this tells us what the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent is actually sort of measuring. It's measuring the radial instability of photon orbits. We can also introduce this gauge invariant quantity called the Lyapunov time. Here I'm showing you the same plot, but now I'm showing you on the y-axis the time as measured by an asymptotic observer. This is something that you can measure. And what you can rewrite this deviation between these two orbits, the radial deviation, you can rewrite it in this fashion. So the Lyapunov time, which you see here in this exponent, is the time for the radius between two orbits that are initially separated by a small amount to grow by a factor of the Euler number. So you can see that this Lyapunov time is also defined by the metric functions and derivatives. So what we can see with all this is that the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent and the Lyapunov time depend not just on the metric functions f and g, but they also depend f and r, but they also depend on this metric function g. So if we were to be able to measure one of these guys, the Lyapunov time or the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent, you would have access to genuinely new information about the spacetime. So that's quite interesting. Finally, what I will also say is that the time delay that I introduced in the previous slide and the Lyapunov time are also related by this nice identity. They are given by the ratio is given by the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent. So what this tells us is that if we were to be able to measure the time delay between two higher order images and also in some other way the Lyapunov time, this would give us an estimate of the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent. So these three are interrelated in this beautiful way. I have to mention this. So if you look at the quasi-normal modes of these spherically symmetric black holes, the real part is actually given by the shadow size, and the imaginary part is given by precisely this Lyapunov time. So there is nice synergy with gravitational waves as well, and black hole like the photon sphere of black holes. So in the Schwarzschild spacetime, these are the numbers. So the photon sphere, as I said earlier, is at 3m in the bulk, and the image of the photon sphere is about 3 root 3 times the times m on the image plane. This Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent is pi, and this Lyapunov time is again root 27 m. So these are the different numbers that we get. Okay, so I told you a little bit about the theory of what these critical parameters are and how they're related to the space-time geometry. Let me tell you a little bit about how we can hope to measure them. So here is a hotspot in a black hole space-time that's moved. Okay, let me actually show you the movie. So here's a hotspot that has gone off in the bulk. It's just some compact emission, flux emission. And this is the n equal to zero image that has appeared on the image plane. You will see now in a short moment that the first order image also appears on the image plane. So if we are able to get these sorts of observations from future black in the future, then we will be able to actually detect the time delay between the two order images, and we'll also be able to detect perhaps the demagnification between these two different images. And so this is what in the future we hope to be able to sort of back out use to back out the delay time as well as the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent. This might be hard, but yeah, we will definitely try. I will skip this because I'm sort of running out of time. But let me show you this. So here, what I'm plotting is the characteristic delay time between the zeroth order image and the first order image, as produced by such a hotspot, when it is located at some location RE in the bulk and at some angular location theta. So the exact time difference between the first and zeroth order images will depend on the angular position of the angular and radial position of the hotspot itself. So this tells you how long what is the difference between the exact time delay and the approximate nice formula that I showed you earlier, which is the characteristic time delay. So this tells us that there is a lot of it does depend on the position of the hotspot, but that we can probably get the characteristic time delay out of this. So on the right here, I have accounted for the angular location of the hotspot and found a different approximate formula that accounts for this. And you can see that the error between the exact time delay between the first and zeroth order images and the analytically produced time delay is much smaller. So this sort of tells us that we can hope to extract the shadow size from future measurements of time delays between the zeroth and first order photon zeroth and first order images. Okay, so now we talked about point sources, these hotspots, roughly point sources. Now let's think about accretion flows. So here I show you the images of here I show you the images again of the accretion flow itself. And what we can find from what we saw for the point source was this, but you can find a similar formula for the diameters of these higher order images, because you can think of each point on the ring as a point source, and therefore roughly a set of point sources, and then you can obtain this sort of nice expression for the diameter differences from the shadow size. This also scales by the exponent by the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent. So if you were to be able to image the whole accretion flow and get such a ring, and let's say also the even one higher order ring, the demagnification between the two would then give you the lenses gap and maximum in a different way. Okay. We can also see that the widths and the flux densities through these rings also scale in this way. So there are multiple different ways in which you could get this lensing gap and maximum from observations if we were able to resolve these things in practice, in principle. Finally, on the Lyapunov time that I mentioned, you can consider this following thought experiment. Let's take a star that is radially falling into a black hole, and so as the star is falling into the black hole, it will emit a bunch of photons, some that will reach you and some that will go towards the black hole and start looping around the photosphere. So these guys are looping around the photosphere, and the star has now passed through the event horizon and fallen in. And these photons that have been looping on the photosphere are still unstable. So they will start getting they will start moving away from the photosphere at late times. And what you will see is this characteristic decay of the luminosity. And this exponential decay is again just given by this Lyapunov time. So in this thought experiment, if you had a star and you could look at this its luminosity and measure its late time decay, you could get the Lyapunov time. But more realistically, we hope that this could also apply to a gas cloud that's falling into Sagittarius star, or maybe even somehow in hotspot measurements as well. But this remains to be seen. But this is roughly the way in which we could independently get the Lyapunov time from actual observations. Okay, so here let me just show you finally what we get from doing all this. Sorry. So let's say that we somehow managed to measure the Lyapunov time or the Lenzing Lyapunov experiment. What do we get from what do we learn about the space-time? That's the point here. So let me define these parameters delta, delta t, and delta gamma as the deviations from the Schwarzschild values of the shadow size, the Lyapunov time, and the Lenzing Lyapunov experiment. I'm showing you here four different parameter spaces. These are different black hole parameter spaces. And this parameter epsilon controls the horizon size. So here, black holes are different from the Schwarzschild value. Here, so all of these black holes are different from Schwarzschild, which is located at 0, 0 on all these axes. So what this tells you is if you look at the black lines, these are isocontours of constant shadow size. So all these black holes on a single black line have the same shadow size. Similarly, all these black holes on the same red line have the same Lenzing Lyapunov experiment. And all the black holes on the green lines have the same Lyapunov time. You can see that they intersect on any of these parameter spaces exactly at one point. Furthermore, I've also shown you what the EHT measurements on the shadow size give us for Sagittarius A in these hatched regions. So what you can see is that you get this infinite degeneracy along certain axes. You cannot constrain certain directions of this parameter space. And this is something that Avery has also shown in a recent paper. And but what we could get from a single additional measurement of either the Lyapunov time or the Lenzing Lyapunov experiment is we get orthogonal isocontours that will actually restrict this parameter space to a compact set. So this will non-trivially produce more stringent tests of gravity. And also, if this patch localizes outside, if it doesn't contain 0, 0, then we get a test of a null test of not Schwarzschild as well. So this is quite powerful. Finally, in the right bottom plot here, I show you a parameter space where the black holes have the exact same shadow size. Therefore, the EHT obtains no constraints on these black holes. But with future measurements of either the Lenzing Lyapunov experiment or the Lyapunov time, you will get certain constraints on this parameter space as well. Yeah. There's
Oh,
a question.
do you hear me?
Yeah.
So these EHT observations, I thought that you're talking about Kerr background, but so why these critical parameters, they don't depend on spin? I mean, I'm confused here.
Yeah, right. Sorry. So I should have said. So
Yeah.
these do definitely depend on spin. But in this, we just looked at spherically symmetric black holes to begin with. And we are currently working with Kiana and Avery to also understand how this whole picture changes when you include spins for these non-curved black holes. So this is ongoing work. But yeah, you're definitely right. This will depend on the spin as well, on the black hole spin as well.
Thank you.
All right. So I will skip this in the interest of time and move to actually the second half of my talk on the black hole simulation, on the numerical simulations of accretion onto curved and non-curved black hole spacetimes. Okay. So in this work, we looked at two sets of black hole spacetimes. In the first, we looked at black holes from string theory. So the black hole metric I show here, it differs from the Kerr metric in because it has these additional terms here. The spacetime contains a scalar field, which is called a dilaton, and an axion field, as well as an electromagnetic field. Now, but it still turns out that there's only one extra independent charge in addition to the mass and the spin, which is this parameter d, which controls the strengths of all three fields, the scalar field, the axion field, and also the electromagnetic. I also show you the actions for the two different theories here. So you can really think of the dilaton-axion theory, which is this low energy effective limit of the heterotic string, as GR plus some additional fields. So these are minimally coupled to gravity, but not minimally coupled between each other, because you can see these kind of things. Okay, so for these spacetimes, we performed a number of numerical simulations solving accretion into these spacetimes. And I show you on the left slices, vertical slices through four different simulations. On the top, in the top row are black holes that are not spinning. In the bottom row are black holes that are spinning. And they have the same spin, approximately 0.5. On the left, in the left column, I have the GR black, general relativistic black holes, the Schwarzschild and the Kerr black holes. And on the right, I have these string theory black holes. So you can see straight off that the size of the horizon differs drastically. This is the black region in all these plots. But in particular, if you look at this extremal dilaton black hole, it's so small that you should expect to see some differences. You can also see structurally differences in the accretion flow itself. These blue regions are where the jet lives, and you can see that this guy doesn't really have a jet. On the right here, I show you images of these simulations for MLT7 at the frequency that VHT observes, this 230 gigahertz. And you can see that this ring here changes size quite drastically when you go from Schwarzschild to the string theory black hole. So you can really tell the difference between these two extreme cases at least. It's also interesting to ask whether you could tell the difference between these two cases, which are not that extreme. And what we find in preliminary investigation is that with future observations at higher flux sensitivity, you can actually tell the difference between these two images as well. So what we've done is reconstructed them using we reconstructed them, and shown on the right here is essentially the intensity as a function of the image radius on the x-axis. And the blue band here is this non-curved black hole, and the red band here is this curved black hole. So you can see that this peak here is where the photon ring lives for both these guys. If you were able to resolve that, then you could tell that they're definitely different. But in case you're not able to resolve that because of not enough angular resolution, you can still see that the central brightness depression is quite different for the two cases. So we'll have access to new information with higher sensitivity measurements in the future, which could help differentiate between these black holes. Okay, so let me now jump into the last part and talk about transitioning slowly into jets. So here I show you for the images and jets for different black hole for a set of Johansson-Saltus black holes. So these set of black holes are different from the ones that I was just talking about, these string theory ones. These are parameterized black hole spacetimes, and in particular, we looked at two different parameters, alpha-1-3. This guy changes the size of the black hole shadow, and alpha-2-2. It changes the quadrupole moment of the black hole spacetime. So it changes also the shadow asymmetry. So this is a slightly busy plot, I guess. So let me go through it step by step. In the top left quadrant here, there are three different panels. The top shows the jet for a Schwarzschild black hole at 86 gigahertz. This for M87. And you can see that it doesn't have a very strong jet. The left bottom image shows you the image of the Schwarzschild black hole at EHT frequencies. And you can see this bright ring, which is basically circular. Here in the right bottom side panel, I show you the image, the same image, but when viewed in the plane of the accretion disk. So you're seeing this from the two different inclinations. This is the inclination for M87, and this is the inclination when you're in the equatorial plane of the black hole. So on the right here, I show you the same set of things for a curved black hole, and you can see that its jet is much more powerful. It's when you see it from close to the pole, from the spin axis of the black hole, the photon ring is also still circular. And finally, if you see it from the equatorial plane, you can see that it's slightly deformed from a circle from the Schwarzschild case. In the bottom here, we show you the Johnson-Saltus black hole with some parameter alpha-1/3, which changes the photon sphere size. And you can see that its jet power is slightly different from that of a curved black hole. Most interestingly is this case, the black hole with a modified quadrupole moment. The quadrupole moment changes the film dragging in these black hole spacetimes. So we've arranged alpha22b in such a way that you have stronger film dragging, and therefore the jet is also much stronger in this case. The stronger film dragging also impacts the image. As you can see, if you were to see this black hole in the equatorial plane, it looks much more deformed from a circle than even the curved case, and definitely much more deformed from the Schwarzschild case. So this is a black hole which has stronger film dragging. So what this tells us is that if you were to be able to see these sorts of images, you could sort of get some sense of how strong the film dragging is in these black hole spacetime. In all these cases, we have chosen the parameters so that they are still consistent with the EHT shadow size bounds. We have not chosen something drastically crazy. Okay, so I promised to tell you about the jet power in the last few minutes that I have. Let me just quickly tell you about what sets the jet power of a curved black hole, of a non-curved black hole. So the way to think about the jet power is I'll present a very heuristic picture. Here's a cartoon of the accreting black hole system. Here is the accretion disk, which is magnetized and hot, and as it flows into the black hole, it's dragging magnetic field lines along with it. Magnetic field lines close to the black hole are shown in these purple lines. They're spinning around the black hole, but I'm just showing you a meridional slice. In this region, the plasma that is sort of the plasma that's present in this region is essentially, it's dominated by the magnetic field. So you can think of it roughly as some magnetized outflows. Okay, so to understand the jet power, let's step back and think of a tube think about the power through a tube. So the power flowing through any tube would be given by the energy density times the area, cross-section area of the tube, times the velocity at which this energy density is flowing. So rho times A times V. For this case, where you have just electromagnetic fields, essentially, the energy density is given by B squared, where B is the magnetic field strength. I've ignored some factors of 8 pi, but this is the energy density. Rg squared is the gravitational radius of the black hole, which is essentially the area of this tube that we're thinking about. And these plasmas are sort of outflowing at relativistic speeds. So you can roughly think of them as going at the speed of c. So this guy gives you the outflow energy in these jets. And it turns out that it's modulated by the spin pattern material. So if you have a zero spin black hole, you get no jet power. Okay. So you can rewrite this all of this in a slightly nicer way, in a more gauge invariant way. And also, yeah, so let me take you through this. So you can define phi, which is called the horizon magnetic flux. This tells you what is the magnetic flux on the horizon, B times area. And this allows you to pick out a factor that depends purely on the space-time geometry. So this has the spin of the black hole and the mass of the black hole. So this guy depends only on the space-time, and this guy depends on the accretion itself, because the magnetic field is determined by the sort of accretion that's happening in these space-times. So this is a simple formula, and we'll try to see if this actually works. So these formula work in the curve metric. We'll try to see if this works in non-curve space-times as well. Okay, so it turns out that this term in the right hand, on the right hand side, A over RG, is actually the angular frequency of the black hole in disguise. And this is a better formula for higher spinning black holes. So the physics of this formula is quite simple. It tells us that the power of the jet is dependent on how much magnetic field you can pack onto the black hole horizon, which is given by this magnetic flux. And also by how fast the black hole is spinning. It's quite simple. So this doesn't really have the specifics of the space-time geometry very explicitly. So we'll try to see if this universally holds for non-curved space-time as well. Okay. So what we can also see is that the minimum power of the jet is just zero. If you have a spinning black hole but no magnetic field, so phi is zero, you'll have a zero. You'll have no outflows. But you can also sort of imagine that the maximum jet power that you can get out of the system is going to be related to how much mass is flowing into the black hole. So m dot here is the rest mass accretion rate. So it's telling you how much it's telling you about how much matter is flowing in. And roughly you can call the maximum jet power to be related in this way. You can define this phi max as the maximum amount of magnetic flux that you can put onto the black hole. And this really depends on the amount of accretion that is allowed in these black hole spaces. Okay, finally, we can introduce this parameter, this eta jet, which is the jet efficiency. What it's telling you is what is the power of the jet per rest mass accretion rate energy. So if you put in one m dot c squared, and you get more jet power, like you get more than one, then what this is telling you is that you are actually extracting energy from the black hole system. You're getting more jet power out of the black hole than the amount of energy that flowed into the black hole, and the only other source is the black hole itself, and this you're extracting energy from the ergo-region of the black hole. Okay. So if the jet efficiency is greater than one, you get energy extraction from the black hole itself. So here we show you the result of our set of simulations. On the top left here are the string theory black holes. On the top on the bottom here are these parameterized black hole spacetimes. And what I'm showing you on each plot is the efficiency that we computed from the numerical simulations versus this function omega h pi h. So omega is the angular frequency of the black hole, which depends only on the space-time itself, and this phi h, which is the maximum amount of magnetic flux that you can pack onto the black hole. And what we expected heuristically was that this guy, this eta, should go as the square of of omega squared phi squared, and that's shown in the black line. So what we find from simulations is that all these black holes follow exactly the same sort of physics. So they're universally described by this sort of very nice simple physics, both in the string theory case as well as in the parameterized black hole case. I will note that I told you about this film dragging earlier. So there are these black hole spacetimes that we have chosen to have large quadrupole moments. And they produce larger powers than is possible in general relativity. So if you were able to see such high powers and measure the efficiency of the jets, you would then be able to say that this is probably not a curved black hole. So with all this, I will conclude. So what we briefly saw was that critical parameters in the future will become accessible, and these are the delay time, the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent, and the Lyapunov time. We hope that these can set up more stringent tests of the spacetime and also of GR. And this would be interesting to learn about. It'd be nice to learn more details about the spacetime geometry if possible. What I didn't mention was that the width of the first higher order image also imposes non-trivial constraints on the spacetime. I didn't have time to go through this, but this is also another observable that can tell us about spacetime. And finally, we use a number of simulations in non-curved spacetimes. These are all completely new, and showed that you could first tell the difference between the images of their jets and also their images at Event Horizon Telescope frequencies as well, at horizon scales. Finally, we looked at the energetics of different black hole jets, and we found this nice universal behavior that the total jet power is just determined by the total magnetic flux on the horizon, as well as the angular frequency of the horizon. So with that, I'll thank you and take questions.
Apologies due to the circular path we all took to get here. We're running a little bit late, so maybe only one or two questions. But well, let's start with people who made it into the room. So Will, go ahead.
Thanks for the nice talk. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about like measuring these critical parameters and the prospects for that. So you said that's like a next generation thing, but not this one. Could you say like how well you expect to measure those and what the biggest uncertainties are? Like, is it the resolution of the instrument itself, or is it like the having to marginalize over all the unknown accretion disk physics and all the variability and things like that?
Yeah, I think I should say that this is stuff that's still there's a lot of investigation that's necessary, but I'll tell you what you know right now. So this image that I showed was with the next generation Event Horizon Telescope array, fiducial configuration of this. So this will be performed at roughly the same angular resolution as these measurements will have the same angular resolution as EHT, but they'll have higher flux sensitivity. We'll be adding more dishes. They'll be able to sort of amp up the sensitivity, and that's what you're seeing essentially in the difference between these two. That you can see, you can tell the difference between these two different features. You're more sensitive to these kinds of changes. So this is, we expect, is going to be possible soon. Another thing I showed you was these sorts of these sorts of hotspot movies. These are, of course, thanks to Ravi. This is a chemist simulation, and also Paul. From recent investigations, it looks like these sorts of simulations might, these sorts of movies will also be possible with the next generation Event Horizon Telescope to actually sort of image. This is still ongoing work, but it looks very promising.
Yes, so I'm just trying to hear, like, if you, I mean, because like, I guess normally you expect not there just to be one hotspot. There's a lot of them, and there's a lot of variability in the disk. But is that going to be the major uncertainty as opposed to the
Yeah,
flux or?
absolutely. So right now we're actually sort of doing a follow-up to all this. This is all just analytic work that I was talking about, today. But we're sort of thinking about exactly the sorts of questions you're asking. If you had a hotspot with some background, say a noise, then could you still pick out the hotspot itself? And yeah, so this is ongoing work, and we think it's possible because there's some work that I know that suggests that you can actually pick these out of GR emission simulations itself. So there is a chance that we'll be able to actually tell, we'll be able to detect these higher order images. But this is still very uncertain, I should say, and very preliminary.
There's a
And
hint of optimism, right? It's not quite so bad. Paul wrote a lot for embedding these things in background that were quite a bit more optically thick than I think the GRMHD simulation seems to be. And we were able to pull them out. And the other thing that's really important, the GRMHD simulations don't produce flares, but we see them. So, regardless of what the simulations do, reality is that there are these very bright, time localized, sometimes periodic events, and they seem dominated by a single bright structure that's moving. there's reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, I'll add to that and say that if you look at these some of these simulations in retrograde MAD curve black hole simulations, in some instances of the movie, in one of these flux eruption events, you actually see half the disk being blown off, almost. So they are quite violent. And yeah, it depends on whether we catch the right flare at the right time. But there's, like Avery says, there's reason to be optimistic. And just to complete the story, I will say that for the photon ring itself, you will need to go to space. We don't think that we'll be able to. So this, the first order image that I mentioned earlier, this, it doesn't seem likely that we can see from the Earth, because you need higher angular resolution. And there are plans to sort of put a single orbiter in space and to get a space-based like VLBI baseline. And with that, it looks pretty optimistic that we'll be able to get something like this, a photon ring like this. So, and we also think that you might get the first order image width, or at least an upper bound on that. So many of these things are going to be possible. What is looking extremely unlikely is that we're going to get this guy, the second order image of the photon ring. And so that's one of the reasons why we want to look for alternative ways to find the Lenzing-Lyapunov exponent by measuring, say, the delay time and the Lyapunov time or something else. This scaling is likely not going to be possible.
Thanks.
So now, Vasant, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, very quickly, where you showed these different models from string theory and, you know, comparing with yes. Have you checked the other points in parameter space? Because that Dilaton one, it seems to be rescaled. I mean, have you tried to also check different masses and spins and, you know, your model parameter, C? It seems that there are some degeneracy in...
That's an excellent question. So what we've done here is we fixed the asymptotic mass of the black hole space in. This is because, so all of these black holes have the same ADM mass. This is because you have measurements of stellar dynamics at like 10 to the 6 gravitational radii. So that's giving you a mass. So we fix those. What we then do is to say that once you have an asymptotic mass fixed, what are the other parameters that you can change? And once you change those parameters, this is what we get. And I showed you only 4 of these. And yes, these are 2 of the extreme cases because they're close to extremality. But we actually have 40 such simulations. And this is just to sort of demonstrate that you can tell the difference, at least in the extreme cases, which is quite nice to know. Right?
Are you also fixing the spin? I mean, because the inclination angle also, I thought it's
absolutely
perfect, right?
Absolutely. So let me just show you this. So, okay, there should probably be a bit, I didn't show this plot, but so this shows the horizon magnetic flux as a function, relative to the Schwarzschild horizon magnetic flux, but that doesn't matter. So what we are showing here in different lines, different colors, is different spin black holes, both retrograde and prograde, and for different Dilaton charges. There's other parameters in the space time. And in particular, the Kerr guys are sitting right here. They all have zero charge. So we look at all of these simulations and then produce images. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So with that, let's thank Chad again.
Thank you.